I'm Paula Herbley of Zogma, the Zogma Podcast.
I'm Trish Roberts-Miller.
And you're a professor
in rhetoric and writing
at UT Austin. Yeah. So I guess I just want to know first what led you to want to write about procrastination and think about it.
I was teaching a class at Berkeley in graduate school, and it was an argumentation course, but we often use literature to get students started on topics. And a really popular book was Death of a Salesman, because it actually raises interesting issues about athletics and failure and things. And I knew that there was somebody at the counseling center who ran this program called Procrastination and Fear of Failure, and asked him to come talk to the class. And one of the first things he said was, I mentioned that one of my roommates always wanted to sign up for his workshop and never got around to it. He said he heard that all the time. So he did a really fascinating presentation for my class about fear of failure and how that relates to procrastination. And that was one of the things that got me interested. And then, of course, I've struggled with procrastination a lot, all sorts of different kinds, and read everything that I can on it. And then found that that's a big issue in advising students, that it's relatively straightforward to tell a student what needs to get changed in a product, but it's very hard to figure out how to talk to them productively about the process.
Yeah, okay. So that then, so you saw this like happening a lot with students and grad students?
Yeah, and then also with myself, and it's we characterize too many different things as procrastination, and so one of the, so for instance, sometimes we talk about procrastination as though it's a weakness of will, and the kind of paradigmatic example would be something like eating a cupcake instead of starting your diet. And so the way, when we phrase it that way, it's that there's, you're doing something pleasurable instead of the real hard work that you should be doing. And if you think of procrastination that way, then the solution to it appears to be, if you beat yourself up sufficiently, then you know, you can do what you need to do. But what I noticed in with myself, that's not the way that it worked, that often I wasn't choosing to eat a cupcake instead of doing my scholarship or something. It was instead that there were all these pressures on me to focus on teaching, focus on service, and I just didn't, I couldn't find the time. And that's a different way to define procrastination. It's actually the way a lot of people who study it in psychology, cognitive psychology, and economics describe it, which is that procrastination isn't a weakness of will as much as it is bad calculation. And so it's that your minute-by-minute decisions don't reflect your long-term goals. So it's not a weakness of will. It's not a bad thing in a person. It's just it's to the extent it's bad, it's kind of bad math or something. And there's also another kind of procrastination, which is what I think of as the just-in-time procrastination. And that's when you leave something to be done until there's only barely enough time to do it. And that's actually potentially a good habit. Because as I mentioned to you before, the example that I really like is one year I decided I would do all my class prep the summer before. So I read all the, everything, and I made notes and everything. Well, I still had to read it the night before. So in fact, procrastinating class prep till just before class is a really smart thing to do. It also reduces the amount of time that you will spend on class prep, since in fact you could always spend more. And I have found that procrastinating paper grading can be really effective for the same reason, that it forces you to make the decisions faster.
Right.
And, but yeah, anyway.
Yeah. It's kind of like, procrastination is something I talk about a lot with my friends, and it seems we have this sort of idea that work will always, it's like kind of like a gas, and that it will expand to fill the space that you have,
right?
No matter how much space that you have,
right? Some of the scholars who work on procrastination talk about essentially three different kinds or three different motives that people have for doing it. And one is one person calls it, if you're the arousal type, and another person calls that talks about it as tedious tasks. So if the tasks are boring, then you might engage in procrastination to make them just more interesting. And then there are also, it's decisional procrastination. And those are tasks that raise issues of indecisiveness. You don't have enough information, you aren't sure you're going to make the right decision. And so for some people, paper grading is in that first category. It's very boring. But for other people, it's in the second category, that it's decisional. And that and people whose personality type is that they are averse to closure, they tend to have a lot more decisional procrastination. So with the first kind, the arousal and tedium, the basic solution is to introduce some kind of rewards. But for the decisional, what I've actually found is shame can be your friend. In that, if you, so I write into my syllabus the days I'm going to turn back papers. And that means I have to get it done by then. And so it, and then the other thing I do is you know how when you're grading papers, you hit one and it's just really complicated and you don't know what to do with it. And you can't keep yourself from putting it at the bottom of the pile. So I leave those till the morning that I have to turn back papers. And I get up at 4:30 in the morning and finish grading. And it means that you have to spend half an hour on it. You can't spend more than that. So at the end of half an hour, if you still don't know what to do, you write, see me. And,
right. You know? Yeah.
But with the third category, which some people call avoiders, and one person who writes a lot about this, he actually has a website where you can test and see what kind you are. He calls it something like existential angst or something like that. But anyway, those are tasks that you put off because doing them raises real issues of self-esteem, and that's where the fear of failure stuff comes in and all that. And so that's often where our scholarship is.
Right.
And so that's why we put it off, because it's just really unpleasant.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the... I kind of want to stay with that point and then also circle back around to the shame can be a good thing.
Uh-huh.
So you say that procrastination is not necessarily a bad thing.
Right.
And that we should maybe embrace it as a method. But isn't that kind of counterintuitive? Like, how do you... I mean, you know that the shame or the, you know, keeping yourself accountable to your students is working, but does it also make you feel really bad too?
That's really important, all this, but I think I'll give you one more set of distinctions that people talk about that I find useful. So one set of people who were studying procrastination, they did this really funny study where they took a whole bunch of people and first they asked them, do you procrastinate? And have you procrastinated in the past? And they found some trivial number of people, some teeny tiny number of people who didn't procrastinate and never had. Okay, so excluding those three people that they turned up in these hundreds that they were studying or something. Then they found a bunch of people who said, yeah, I have a real issue with procrastination. And they called those people sophisticates because they're, I think self-aware would have been a better term, but anyway. They know that they procrastinate, and so they take that into consideration in making commitments. And then there's another set that they call naive procrastinators, and those are people who either think they don't procrastinate or think that they could quit at any time. And those are the people who get in the most trouble. And those are the people who think that they can will themselves out of it. And so, and it's because they're going back to that sort of cupcake analogy of thinking of it that way. So the O'Donohue and somebody else, I can't remember the other person's name, did this study where they gave people a task that had two parts. And they said, if you commit to both parts of the task and you complete both, you get $10 or something. If you commit to half of the task and you complete it, you get $5. If you commit to the whole task and only complete half of it, you don't get anything. And so... and what they discovered is the naive procrastinators had a tendency to commit to the whole task and get nothing done, and get halfway through, and so get no money. And I find that really interesting because I think, in fact, the people who have the most difficulty managing their procrastination effectively don't acknowledge that they do it, or they think that they can will themselves out of it. So that's one thing. Then the other thing is, I think it's hugely helpful to figure out what kind of procrastination you're doing, because there are different solutions. So there's no point in being ashamed of being a procrastinator, because that means that you're in the 99.5%. Mm-hmm. But But just to figure out what, when you're doing it, why you're doing it, and probably you're doing, I mean, I think all of us do all three kinds. And then to figure out the costs. Because some procrastination has trivial costs. I still haven't put my photos in photo albums from a trip we took last June. Mm-hmm. It's okay.
Yeah, it's not. And the thing is that the more you procrastinate, like, the worse it seems. Like, it just sort of builds up and builds up into this huge thing. And then you're like, oh, I have to do this. Why haven't I done this thing?
Right.
Such a simple thing to do, and I haven't done it, and then...
Right, and so, and that's where the shame is not helpful, because what it means is that you can take a task that is, in fact, you don't want to do it because it's tedious, but if you feel a lot of guilt about not having done it, then doing that tedious task now means not only do I have to put photos in the album, but I have to confront my sense of inadequacy for not having done it till now, as opposed to just saying, I didn't do it till now. So what? It's okay. Right. It doesn't matter.
So not all shame is good.
Right. No, not all shame is good.
Shame is not always your friend.
No. So yeah, it's not always your friend. But like procrastination, you can use it, and you can figure out how to get it to motivate you effectively, and what are times you just need to put it off. And in fact, one of the things that can be really helpful in getting over procrastination is to procrastinate the shame.
Uh-huh.
and to procrastinate the angst. And so instead of telling yourself, for instance, in preparing job market materials, which people tend to procrastinate a lot, mm-hmm. because it raises tons of anxiety, it's really hard, you don't know that you're doing it right, and it's very hard not to worry about the consequences, to give yourself permission to worry about all that, but not while you're writing it, to just go ahead and write the material, but really to set aside some time, like while you're, I love doing that kind of thing while walking the dogs, because eventually the dogs distract you. But some people like the shower for that. But you know, just some time that you're going to go ahead and engage all of that angst. But you procrastinate it.
I see. Until like you're doing something that is like not very
right.
high stakes.
Right.
Yeah. So you just have like a really angsty shower.
Right. Yeah.
That's yeah. funny. That's good. Yeah. So I mean, so like if one of your students like emails you and says like I'm really having trouble with this chapter or this paper or whatever, do you tell them that, or like how do you counsel them?
Well, it's kind of weird. In graduate school, I never figured out a time to do this, but in my undergraduate class, in all of them, on the first time they turn in papers, I actually have this 45 to 60, depending on how long the class is, minute lecture on procrastination, and start with all the stuff that guy did many years ago at Berkeley, because I think it was a really useful way of explaining it. And his basic explanation is that for a lot of us, we are very talented writers, and we're very smart, and that's an important sense of our who we are. And so we get to college, and suddenly it's not so easy. We aren't the smartest kid in the room. And so our sense of self is threatened by that. And there are various ways of responding to that. One of them is actually to fail, and to fail spectacularly and publicly, and in a way that makes it clear that it was never a test of your actual abilities. You get in fights with teachers, you drink, you whatever. Another one is to work really, really, really hard and just make sure that you continue to get the grades that will enable you to feel good about yourself. And procrastination is both the best and worst of both worlds. Procrastination is fucking up very publicly, and everybody has to know about it. You're not doing all the work you should be doing. You know that you're engaged in this kind of procrastination when you find yourself hanging out in somebody's doorway telling them how you're not working. So, you know, and then at the last minute, you suddenly get down to work. Well, what that does for you is, for us, I should say, is that it means that the product we turn in is not a genuine test of our ability. And so it enables us to procrastinate in a really bad way this thing that we see coming. And it has to do with most of us having a kind of some version of imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
So the other thing that it's connected to that I think is really interesting and is connected to imposter syndrome, is what this one woman, Carol Dweck, calls the fixed mindset versus growth mindset. And a lot of our culture has a fixed mindset model, which is that you were given X amount of intelligence or talent or whatever when you were born. And what happens in your life is that number gets revealed to the rest of the world. And for a talented person, the most terrifying thing is for people to realize they've overestimated us. And so what we would rather have is we'd actually rather get a D and not have tried than to do our absolute best and get a B+. That's the most terrifying thing possible. And so we're always trying to prevent that. You do your absolute best and get a B+. Because we see that B+ as the moment of truth when it is revealed that is actually our talent. Growth mindset, however, says that there is no test that is your ultimate test because you could always work more on it. And so instead of thinking that you have, well, okay, let me back up and put it this way. So there was never a chance in my life that I would play NBA. I did not, in fact, have the genes for that. But I could get better at basketball than I am. And so to some extent, there is a limit as to, you know, there may be some sort of limit as to how talented you can be in sports or athletics. It's not clear whether that connects to intelligence, but you could get better. And so the one of the other ways to combat that fear of failure is not to see any test as the one that's going to make your professors go, oh, shit, I thought she was smart. It turns out she's really stupid. Mm-hmm. But instead as, you know, just something you're turning in.
Yeah. Wow, all of this sounds so familiar. Can we backtrack really quickly and can you just tell me what imposter syndrome is? I know what it is, but...
Yeah, so imposter syndrome is the sense that we have been wildly overestimated and that we're an intellectual fraud, and that those whom the gods wish to destroy, they first call promising. Mm-hmm. So it's just that. And in fact, the other thing that I've discovered, so Scientific American recently had a fairly good article on it, which I actually put in my course pack for my undergrads. But there's also something tremendously private about it. We think that we're the only one who feels that way. And I remember at one point in graduate school at a party discovering that everybody in my cohort thought each of us was the one that was the admissions mistake. Yeah. And that there had been a smart Patricia Roberts they meant to let in. And that everybody else totally understood what was going on. And each of us thought we were the only one who was lost and who was simply pretending to get it. In addition, every one of us had a narrative that went with that of, I'm struggling because I didn't do enough philosophy as an undergrad. I'm studying because I'm basically from the working class. I'm really struggling because I'm a woman. I'm struggling because whatever. You know, then in each of these we had this narrative, and so understanding that struggling was not actually a sign that we were failures, but it was a sign that we were learning.
About
that we were learning new stuff, which is why you go to grad school. So it's actually a good sign about our graduate program.
Right, because then you realize what you don't know.
Right, yeah.
It's like the first step towards knowing what you, like knowing that stuff, learning that stuff.
Right. And so instead of seeing each of these experiences as a test, to see them as opportunities to learn or experiences, you know. The other thing I think this is connected to, and this is totally my crank theory, is that for some reason when it comes to writing, we don't really take seriously that it's a craft. Because if you are a painter, if you are a musician, if you're an athlete, you spend a huge amount of time playing the violin when nobody's listening and it's not a performance. And that you don't say, oh, I wasted 6 hours today playing the violin when nobody heard me and it didn't turn into anything. You don't say that if you're a tennis player. You practice a lot. But for some reason, particularly when it comes to the dissertation, if we write a lot that doesn't turn into a final product, we talk about as wasted or dead ends or all that stuff. But why can't we see it the same way that a person does a ton of sketches before they do a painting?
Right, it's practice.
It's just practice.
Yeah, it's like there's this weird emphasis on productivity, mm-hmm. right? That you have to, like, have a finished polished product that you can show to people, and that's what work is.
Right.
Work isn't just like screwing around and
right.
writing a blog post right. and write like even if it's still writing, right?
Yeah.
So it's still honing your craft. Yeah. So that kind of brings me to. So I want to know if you think that this is really singular to academics, or maybe even academics in the humanities, or do other people experience imposter syndrome and this shame around procrastination in the same way?
Yeah, so imposter syndrome, there's some hypothesis that it's actually more prominent in the sciences. At first, people thought it was more prominent among women. And then they turned up some research that said maybe not. Now they're turning up research again that says maybe it's hard to figure out that aspect of it. But it's definitely all over the place. Mm-hmm. And procrastination is as well. The last time I was looking up the data on this, something like 50% of people who are admitted into graduate programs generally finish. They actually get the PhD. And most of that attrition is at the point of writing a dissertation. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's probably because, in fact, procrastination is an extremely effective way to write papers as an undergrad and even through coursework. Because you can say you should start your paper early, but you can't, usually. You don't have the information. You know, in the classic way that the end of semester paper in an undergraduate course works, you're getting a lot of the information in lecture or reading that you need for that. So you actually cannot start it earlier. And for the most part, it's the same way with graduate school. In addition, what tends to happen is that, so there's process product, which we talk about a lot, but there's actually process product, short-term consequences, long-term consequences. And the short-term consequences of turning in the product, the paper, will be a grade. Then there are long-term consequences. You'll get into grad school, you won't get into grad school, you'll be a waitress in Barstow, which has always been my most horrible possibility. And because I can't pour coffee, and so I never get tips, and I hate Barstow. What happens, particularly if you're prone to imposter syndrome or fear of failure, is you sit down at that process moment. You should be drafting or reading or whatever. And your mind keeps going to long-term consequences. And they might be positive. You're going to write this brilliant paper. Your teacher's going to love you. They're going to give the first Pulitzer Prize for Rhetoric 306 paper, whatever. Or negative, that you're going to end up a waitress in Barstow because this is going to be the one where you're exposed as a total fool and the teacher's going to distribute it in class as the stupidest paper in the history of the universe. Okay. So because you're so focused on either the positive or negative, it actually gets really difficult just to write the goddamn draft. What procrastination does for you is the panic of the deadline actually enables you to stop thinking about those long-term solutions. So a lot of people get dependent on procrastination as their writing process because it's the only thing that enables them to focus on the process. And therefore, they're perfectly sincere when they say they cannot start a paper earlier because they sit down to start a paper earlier and their brain keeps going to that stuff. People with ADD have a much harder time, starting that. So what happens in the sciences, by the way, is that people do the research. They perform the experiments and all that sort of stuff. But they either can't write grants or they can't write up the results of their research. So they have it just as much. It seems to me, in reading all this stuff on procrastination, that people tend to procrastinate writing.
So it's always writing?
I think so, but I'm not sure. Because I don't think anybody has really tried to suss that out. The other stuff that people procrastinate that there's a ton of research on is quitting smoking, going to the doctor, and saving for retirement. And the reasons for those are all a little bit different, but in any case, back to the writing thing. So what seems to work is, there are two hugely different strategies for dealing with if you can't write. You can't sit down to write because your brain goes to the long-term consequences. One, which works, but it's really painful, is to set arbitrary deadlines and get yourself all worked up about them. So you work yourself into a panic earlier. Mm-hmm. And I think that is not a sustainable way to live. So, but it works. And so lots of people will give you that advice. Another one is to procrastinate thinking about the long-term consequences. So it's kind of like the thing about you can do all that angsty stuff, but you're going to do it in the shower, you're going to do it while walking the dogs, you're going to do it on a treadmill, whatever. There does seem to be something about if you're doing something physical, it's better. But swimming is another time that it's good to then you think about that stuff. But and then what tends to happen, too, is if you can tell a different story. So the story we're telling ourselves is none of my accomplishments up to this point really mean anything because I got them on the basis of luck. People didn't really notice how bad it was, whatever. The muse of undergraduate papers spoke to me. But this is the moment I'm going to be exposed. And so instead of telling that story, the story that you tell is, I have done this before. I have done something like this before. I have succeeded before. I have failed before, and I lived through it. So, if I do get a B+ on this paper, I'll be okay. I will not be a waitress in Barstow. I will be a person who got a B+ on a paper.
Right. And then keep working.
Right, yeah.
So it's about changing the narrative.
It is, yeah. It's all about the story you're telling yourself about it.
And I guess that in order to be able to change the narrative, you have to be, and this goes back to what you were saying earlier, self-aware enough to know that you're procrastinating, that you have a thing called imposter syndrome, and that everybody has it.
Right.
Right? And everybody procrastinates.
Right.
So, I mean, for me, it sounds like for you too, that came after like a couple of years of graduate school.
Right.
And I was able to talk to people about these things and then discovered that, everybody was having similar problems. But you're taking the approach of, like, actually exposing, like, undergrads to this sort of thing, like, in class.
Yeah.
As a way of preparing them for writing.
Yeah. I keep struggling with procrastination in different ways because there's this entirely different, it's not entirely different, but there's, it looks entirely different when you're in that moment. Mm-hmm. So there's, when you know you're procrastinating because you're sitting there, you know you should be working on your dissertation and you're not. But a different kind of procrastination happens when you're doing what you think you should be doing in the moment. And that's what tends to happen to assistant professors. And that's where your chair has asked you to be on this committee, you're directing a writing program, you've got 3 classes, there are all these obligations. And the people in time management talk about that as you're dealing with what's urgent. And you just spend all your time with what's urgent, and therefore you don't necessarily get around to what's important. This is where the saving for retirement comes in, or the seeing the doctor. Unless you're really, really sick, if you put off seeing the doctor a day, it doesn't really matter. It's the next cigarette is not the problem cigarette. It's that you never quit, right? Failing to save for retirement today is not that bad a problem. Choosing to prepare class instead of working on scholarship is not that big a deal today. It's that you have too many days that are along those lines.
Right.
But what I think is also helpful is to try to figure out what we're getting, what reward system is built into our habits. And in that case, teaching provides a lot more immediate feedback than scholarship does, and so does service. And so, basically CowClicker is the single most brilliant thing in the universe. Do you know what CowClicker is?
No, what is that?
Well, this guy wanted to make fun of like Farmville and stuff and all these Facebook games that just rely on you click on something. And if you click on it enough, you get a reward. And so it was a joke, but it's just a cow and you click on it. And if you click on it enough, you get a different colored cow or something. Well, he's made a whole bunch of money on this because in fact, people will sit there and click on a cow.
Oh my God.
Right. Yes. So, humans are prone to feedback. And so one of the things that tends to make teaching or service, even though it's hard, even though it's work, it's not sitting on the couch eating a cupcake. It's hard work. But the reason we choose that over scholarship is that you get that immediate feedback. You go into class, students are excited, you have a good class discussion, or you don't.
Right.
When I was directing the comp program, a student would come and talk to me, we'd brainstorm their assignment, they'd walk out with a much better assignment. Right. But if I took that 45 minutes and read a book, is the book going to be part of my, you know, project? I don't know. Maybe
yeah,
not.
Yeah.
And so that's where this goes back to that sketch thing of you. It's important that we tell ourselves that the 45 minutes you spent reading were actually productive. And so lots of systems for dealing with procrastination make sure you have some kind of feedback on that. Yeah. There's a for years I've been telling students that I think setting process rather than product goals is good. So instead of saying I'm going to write a chapter of my dissertation this semester, to say for one thing, smaller things, what you're going to do this week, I'm going to write 5,000 words. And if 3,000 of those words are, I have no clue what I'm doing, then that's okay. You wrote 5,000 words. So, or you're going to write for a certain amount of time, or you're going to read for a certain amount of time. Somebody recently did a study on productive faculty, and it turned out that people who publish a lot set process goals. Hmm. So, I got confirmed. I was happy.
Right. So it's like you have to be okay with, like, because I know what you're talking about, because I teach and I'm also finishing my diss, and like if you don't prepare for class, it's gonna be a bad class. You know it's a bad class. You know what you have to do next time.
Right.
But then if I sit there and write, it feels like I'm writing into the abyss.
Right.
Like I'm writing into a void. And
right.
Like nobody cares. Like,
right.
Am I gonna show this to anybody? I
right.
don't know.
You right.
know? So it becomes about like proving to myself and to others that if I work, I can do something.
Yeah.
Just like. Writing is much less performative in that sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and so there are all sorts of strategies. So, I mean, if that's the issue, it's that you're not getting feedback or something, then this guy actually sells these things. I think it's funny. So little bubble sheets, and each bubble is 15 minutes, and you set a goal for yourself. If I'm going to work on my dissertation for 2 hours, and every time you complete 15 minutes, you fill in a little bubble. And so at the end of it, you go, look, I filled in all those bubbles. Pomodoro is a similar sort of strategy. You work for 25 minutes, you know, you get it. But you can also just give yourself your own rewards. But it's interesting that even little ones like, you know, filling in bubbles will work. In terms of rewards, the research suggests that the three kind of awards you want to avoid are carbs, alcohol, and TV.
Oh, no. I was like, oh, I do all this.
Right, I know. And so because they're mildly depressive, each of them. And so, but what I really like also about the Pomodoro system is that you stop work after 25 minutes and you get a 5-minute reward. I tend to do longer things. I tend to do 50 minutes and then a 10-minute break. Mm-hmm. But if possible, I think some kind of like getting up and walking around.
Right.
But if at the end of the day you can watch TV or have cookies or have a glass of wine or whatever, then it's fine. But the little rewards you're giving yourself along the way. The other one that is interesting that apparently doesn't work, according to people who've researched this, punishment doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And particularly what doesn't work is if you say, I have to exercise for half an hour today or else I'm going to have to exercise for an hour tomorrow. Because all that happens is you end up at some point with owing yourself 72 hours of exercise.
Yeah, it's funny that you should mention these because I'm doing a little segment on Pomodoro and other like productivity software things,
uh-huh.
which discovering these things in itself becomes a mode of procrastination, right? Like, we
right.
look at Lifehacker for
right.
two
right.
hours and download all these things and then, you know,
right.
just on your computer and you don't really do anything with them. But so we tested out our podcast group tested out Pomodoro, and then I guess we tested out something that would go under the rubric of punishment mode, which was something called Write or Die.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That sounds terrible.
Doesn't it? It yeah. sounds really terrible. Although, you know, the way they explain it on the rhetoric, the rhetoric on the website is very, like, we're going to make you
yeah.
so slightly sinister.
Yeah.
But the way it works is you write into a field on this website. I think you can download an application too, but we only did the web version. And you set a time and you set a goal. So I'm going to write 1,000 words in 10 minutes. And then once you go past that time, and if you haven't reached your word goal, then it starts to erase stuff at the beginning.
Oh, that's terrible. Oh, that's terrible. Oh, that's so bad.
And I tried this, and it didn't work for me because I just got angry.
Right, exactly, yeah.
But it worked for some of the other people in the group, so I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
I'd never do that because that's totally fear-based.
Right.
Like, it was terrible. So that rings true to me, what you're saying, that the punishment mode is just not, it's kind of counterproductive.
Well, I don't know if it still is around, but there was a webpage called finish.org, finish spelled with a PH, and what that did is it's essentially a community, and what is really good about it is that you would post, you know, I'm going to write for 45 minutes, and then you'd go off and write for 45 minutes, and you'd come back and say, I wrote for 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. And everybody who was on at that moment would go, whoop, yay, sending you good vibes, you know. And if you notice, a lot of, there are various programs out there that if you run a certain distance, it posts it to your Facebook, and then your friends can go, good job. And I really think that we should have this, something like that, both for grading and then also for doing scholarship. So it would post and you know, say, Hala wrote 4 pages today, and all your friends could go, whoop, good job. Wouldn't it be great? Yeah.
I mean, that kind of, the thing about that is that it's digital rather than, I mean, so what I usually do is, like, I get a bunch of my friends and we go to the coffee shop and work, and I'm like, oh, I just had this great idea. And then, you know, if that happens, and they're all like, yeah, that's so cool, you know, write it down. And it's that kind of, you know, you have a community and they support you in that way. But I guess the difference there is that it's digital, it's on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, and then you get, you know, people that you went to high school
with. Right.
You.
Yeah, and I think that's also why writing groups work, because writing groups simultaneously have that you simply have to get it done by a certain date, or you're embarrassed, and then it's also people saying, hey, this is really cool, because it's just a fact that unless you're a narcissistic jerk, you are aware of the flaws in what you've just written, and so it's... we are not very good readers of our own writing, and we really don't know when we've written something good and when we've written something bad, and it's important to get that feedback. Another set of those kind of time management things that can be really, really useful is are in the obsessive timekeeping strategy. And I've been doing this since like last March, partially because I'm involved with mentoring associate professors and I want to be able to give them honest advice. And it's a little bit like keeping a food diary, in that you often have images of how much you eat. So the first time I kept a food diary, I was astonished to discover that although I'm vegetarian, I was eating like no vegetables. Mm-hmm. and so the like Toggle is one of these, and there are various others. And so if you obsessively keep track of it, you can find out where you're losing time, that, and also just be more honest with yourself. Mm-hmm. So I didn't realize, I used to work on campus every day, and I didn't realize how much time that was taking me. That in fact, it was about a half hour between the time I got up from my desk at home before I even got into my car, because I had to find this and find that and collect these things. And similarly, it would take me 15 or 20 minutes here before I even got up and really left the office. And so that was interesting. And then also I learned that I was spending more time on scholarship than I was aware of, and that there's a lot of time that I thought I was unproductive, and it's because I wasn't producing a product, but I was in fact upgrading my computer, which involves 6 steps, because, you know,
something you have to do.
You have to do it, yeah.
So it's just about, so that's about like accounting for every block of time and describing what you do?
Right, and then it just, as with a food diary, enabled me to make better decisions, to realize I'm wasting this sort of time. For instance, I learned that I didn't think I spent that much time on a scholarly mailing list, but I was spending way too much time on it, and I needed to, you know, cut back how often I posted to that.
So it sounds like all of these solutions, and it sounds right to me, is that part of it is just being aware.
Yep.
Like, you can't just, sit down and write, like, you have to know yourself, know what your writing patterns are like, or what your, you know, how you behave while you're writing, and just, just know about these things, which I think a lot of grad students, or definitely undergrads and a lot of grad students, too, kind of come in not having the kind of, I mean, I know this was how I was. I kind of thought that things just spontaneously erupted from me, and I would sit down and write it. And, like, I never really thought about, you know, like, the process, I guess.
Well, you didn't need to. And so you didn't, people procrastinate because it's worked for them up to this point. And when procrastination becomes a problem is when you continue to procrastinate and it's costing you and you won't let it go. And it's the same thing with most graduate students that I work with made it through undergrad with an extremely truncated writing process. They picked a topic, they did all the reading for the topic, they read until they came up with an idea or until the deadline was looming, and then they just started to write. And that worked. So there's nothing wrong with that process. It worked, and it's going to continue to work. There will always be things that you can write that way. But it doesn't work when you have to write a dissertation. And so that's the moment that people need to be able to develop a different writing process. Mm-hmm. And then if the writing process you still rely on is one where you're letting panic drive the bus, that's the way I always describe it, you can get through your dissertation. It gets harder to publish the first book, but it is almost impossible to publish the second book because there's never really that deadline. And so if your writing process is fueled by panic, then you either have to do that thing I was saying where you kind of induce panic, or else at some point it's just going to stop working for you. And it's just the costs are too high.
Yeah.
But it worked, right? Yeah. And that's how we got through undergrad. And I think that there are still some things that, like in a way, what I'm describing about one strategy for grading papers is you just let that deadline force you to do it. Because there is not, in fact, a paper grading fairy. I know this. I have let the stack of papers sit there for, you know, 5 days and it never happened. There's not a paper grading muse. There's not, you know, one that comes and inspires you to say exactly the right things or to make it. It's going to be as hard on the first day as it is on the sixth day. So if you commit to returning papers on a certain day, then you just do that. You reminded me of something else that was going to, a different kind of, oh, I know what it was, about the mindfulness. And there's that whole problem of your minute-to-minute decisions not reflecting your long-term decisions,
mm-hmm.
and staying in that kind of urgent and important box. One of the things that does is it makes life much more exciting.
Uh-huh.
And it is, there's a drama to it. There's a very exciting drama, and it fits our kind of romantic notion of the writer and all that.
Yeah.
So it's very pleasurable. And a lot of people love being in a crisis-driven, they love being in the crisis-driven mode. And so moving to a less panicked writing process means letting go of the pleasures of crisis, which is not always easy. In addition, there are two wildly different strategies for handling it, and I actually think that both can work, but most people tend to pick one or the other. And one is the Stephen Covey 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, I think it's called. And so what you do is, at a certain point in time, you sit down and you think about, what are my 5-year goals? And then you figure out, if you're going to achieve those 5-year goals, what do you need to achieve at what point? And then on a weekly basis, you say, this is what I'm going to do on a weekly basis. So see, there's a yearly goal.
Yeah. Yeah. Lists all over the place.
Right. Yeah. It's because I have to externalize memory. I'm an out of sight, out of mind person.
Mm-hmm.
The other strategy though is the getting things done. Strategy, which a lot of people like too, and that's where you just anytime there's a certain, but what both of them share is there's a certain time in your week that is devoted to thinking about what you're doing that week, and to going through your inbox and to going through and the getting things done. I just find overwhelming in terms of how complex it is, but you know you decide when you're going to deal with something, and then it comes
right
back. What I learned about writing a book and certain other kinds of projects is that you have to work backwards from what has to have been done by a certain point, And if that's the case, what has to have been done at each stage along the way? Mm-hmm. And that's really hard to do when you're writing a dissertation. Because I know how long it takes me to write a chapter because I've done it enough to know. You've never written a dissertation.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So you don't know.
Yeah.
And no one knows it about you. Some people have a fairly consistent process where every 6 months they produce a chapter. And that means in 2 years, they're going to have essentially 4 chapters. And that's fine. Some people, a lot of people read for a year and then produce a chapter every 3 months, which is fine too.
Right.
A small number of people read for a year, dither for 6 months, and then write the whole thing in 6 months. And so, you know.
Yeah. So it's just about knowing yourself and knowing what you do.
Right, and you can't know it while you're writing a dissertation. So you just have to like learn by going where you have to go, to put it in Rothke's terms.
Yeah.
So you start out trying any one of them. And
that makes the sort of like, I'm stuck in, I don't know, about writing books.
Uh-huh.
I'm still kind of grappling with a disc. But that makes like year 4, year 5 of your graduate program like kind of this weird twilight zone.
It is.
You're switching over from coursework to writing this huge thing. And it's just like, I mean, I guess that happened to me. Like, I was just, like, all of a sudden I have all this time.
Right.
Because I'm not going to classes anymore and just don't know what to do with it.
Right.
And my fellowship semesters were just like a bust.
Right.
You know?
But they weren't necessarily, I mean, that's what I was saying too about, and I even find that at the micro level that I'm sitting and I'm working and I get completely stuck on a chapter, or, I mean, on a paragraph actually, you know, just like, I don't know what I'm doing here, and get up and walk the dogs or turn compost, which is another really gratifying thing. And at the end of doing that for half an hour, come back and just brilliantly write the paragraph. It's perfect. I know exactly what I'm doing. Sometimes I come back and look at it and go, I still have no clue. So it's also, those kinds of things, I think it can be very difficult to know when you are procrastinating and when you're actually, and just letting the dough rise, you know.
Yeah.
What I was going to say though is that, so one strategy is, I discovered, for instance, when I was teaching that when I'm in the midst of teaching, I make very bad decisions about time management. Students ask me for an extension on the paper and I'll think, oh, sure, that'll work out fine. And I can't keep the arc of the whole semester in. And so then suddenly we end up with like too many papers due really close to each other because of the extensions. And so I learned that what I have to do is before the semester begins, map out every day, every single class day. So I have these super obsessive, like, this is what we're reading for that day, this is what the students are going to be writing about, this is when the papers are due, this is when I'm going to return the papers, this is when, these are the paper prompts, it's all done ahead of time. And then I, you know, the day of class, look and say, this is what we're doing. It's,
right.
You know, it's decided.
Yeah.
So it can actually be really helpful in moments of when you've got a lot of stuff going on and you're really panicked to make a super obsessive list about what you're going to do and when you're going to do it and what you're going to read and when you're going to read it. Because what that stops is that thing that we tend to do at certain points in a project where you pick up a book and you start to read it, but the whole time you're reading it, you're thinking, is this what I should be reading?
Right.
Maybe I should be reading that other thing. Maybe I should be writing. So then you pick up that other thing, you start reading, you know, and that you just don't get anything done because you don't know if you're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
So that super obsessive scheduling can help you at that moment because you say, I am reading this because this is what I decided I would be reading today. And that's what you do.
Right.
But most, I mean, I know people who are OCD enough that they can spend a whole long time like that, but I can't.
Yeah, it seems like it would take a lot of work right at the front end, right?
Right. Well, yeah. And then also as you, at least for me, when I pursue a project, what I think it's going to be like at the beginning versus how it ends up. So there comes a point when you read and you discover, I need to read this other thing.
Yeah.
But you can do something. I'll show you this. So, see the orange?
Uh-huh.
Those are weeks that I'm grading, and so they're blocked off in orange in my on my calendar, so I don't commit to a lot of other stuff during that week.
That's cool. Yeah, that takes a lot of responsibility. I think we're about out of time.
Okay.
Which I wanted to ask you about the whole pleasure thing because, I mean, I don't think we have time now. Uh-huh. Do you have to, like, rush somewhere?
No, huh?
Okay, well, then I guess just for, like, a minute. So you mentioned, let's see, letting go of the pleasurable aspects of procrastination. And it's and while we were talking about productivity software, me and my group, it occurred to me that it's all about managing pleasure. Like that's
yes.
what those softwares allow you to
yeah.
do, right? So like when you write for 25 minutes on Pomodoro, you get the break,
right?
And you know, or when you write, there's this other application called 750 Words where you just write free write, and then it gives you a badge,
right?
You know, or something like that, and you
yeah.
kind of accumulate these points. And then even with Write or Die, it's kind of mired in this weird, like, sadomasochist
right.
rhetoric, and it's kind of all about, like, you know, I mean, that's sort of a different kind of pleasure, right? So, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's anything there, but it's just interesting that the pleasure that we once got out of reading, maybe, is sort of transferred to, like, the sort of as we get more professionalized, becomes the pleasure of being productive and of producing things and
yeah.
you know, and I guess those applications like just help us manage that.
Well, right. And if you're a good writer, the pleasure you often took in it was somebody praising your writing. Uh-huh. And you have to delay that. Or not delay it, I don't know what the right word is, but let that one go too.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's too long before anybody's going to read your chapter or read your book or whatever and say, this is a good book. And in fact, it's so long that with my first book, when I opened the box that had it in there, I was kind of terrified because my first thought was, oh shit, someone with a name like mine wrote a book on the Puritans. It just did not look like mine at all. The pleasure that you need to take is actually in the process. You have to take pleasure in the sense that you wrote all that stuff, whether it's good or not that you did it. Some people suggest that what matters is if you redefine it, if you connect these things with your being a certain sort of person, so that instead of I am a good writer, I'm a person who writes a lot.
Uh-huh.
And so that, you know, that's where you take the pleasure, and not that you have created deathless prose, because I never have, but because you've gotten an idea down there, and you've written all those words.
I like that. That's a nice idea. Okay, this has been really great.
Oh, good.
I really enjoyed this conversation.